We are not going to do denuclearization incrementally. The president has been clear on that, and that is a position around which the U.S. government has complete unity.
The United States hardens its stance in nuclear talks with North Korea. It's Wednesday, March 13th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Glad to have you with us. You'll also find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, human rights, a concern for Rohingya. Undercover, Down Under, revealed. Hard times for big companies in Asia. Studying a living fossil and the popularity of pawning. It's all on today's VOA Asia. North Korea must completely give up its nuclear weapons before the United States begins lifting sanctions. That comment came Monday from the top U.S. envoy on North Korea, and it suggests the United States is hardening its position following the second summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, a meeting that failed to result in a deal. More from VOA's Bill Gallo.
For the U.S., it's an all-or-nothing approach to getting rid of North Korea's nuclear weapons. Though President Trump had signaled flexibility ahead of his summit last month with Kim Jong-un, the top U.S. negotiator for North Korea is now sending a tougher message.
We are not going to do denuclearization incrementally. The president has been clear on that, and that is a position around which the U.S. government has complete unity.
Kim has said he's willing to begin dismantling parts of his nuclear program in exchange for the U.S. taking corresponding measures. In particular, Kim wants sanctions relief. North Korea appears to be backing up that demand with a threat of more missile tests. Commercial satellite images suggest North Korea has rebuilt parts of a satellite launching station and increased activity at a site used to assemble ballistic missiles and rockets.
It's their anger at the summit not ending well, but it's also ratcheting up pressure for future negotiations. This is their traditional negotiating posture. You know, turn up the heat, shoot a missile.
The big question is how Washington would respond to a North Korean missile test.
I would be very, very disappointed in Chairman Kim, and I don't think I will be, but we'll see what happens.
The current deadlock is a major test of whether the Trump-Kim relationship can help revive the faltering nuclear negotiations. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, a different story in South Korea, where a very small number of patients there can soon get cannabis-derived medicine. But as Kurt Achen reports from Seoul, some say the moves toward medical legalization are too limited.
Jenny Huang straps her son, Ian, into a chair on the floor each night so she can feed him his dinner in their home just outside Seoul. Ian has an extremely rare form of child epilepsy called Lennox-Gastaut syndrome. It impairs his movement, coordination, and cognitive ability. His mother and father are both medical doctors. They've tried nearly everything, surgery, changes in diet, and other therapies, but they say there's only one treatment that has visibly done Ian some good, cannabis oil, derived from what is more commonly called marijuana.
After that oil, we've noticed some difference from his eye contact. Most of the times he's been like staring. You know, don't know where he's looking at or what he's thinking. But after that, about 2-3 weeks later, we noticed that he's looking at something. He's looking at me. I can see what he's looking at. It was the first time we ever saw him sitting up from lying down position. And that's really shocking. It was really something.
Law enforcement officials have confiscated cannabis oil from Huang in the past, upholding the country's strict ban on marijuana and other drugs. But a recently amended law may help Ian and a very limited group of other South Korean patients receive cannabis-derived treatment. Starting this month, only South Korean patients with Lennox-Gastaut syndrome and Dravet syndrome, a second rare form of epilepsy, will be legally entitled to receive doses of an imported cannabis-derived medicine called Epidiolex. It won't be at the local pharmacy. There's an online application process, and only one organization in the whole country will handle distribution. Kang Song-suk is a Christian minister and activist who pushed hard for the amendment of the law. He's with the Korea Medical Cannabis Rights Center, which he describes as the country's only cannabis legalization NGO. He has back problems and other health issues that he says cannabis would alleviate, but the amended law excludes him and millions of other South Koreans from obtaining it. He complains that needs to change.
대마보다
There are drugs that require 10 times more caution than cannabis and are prescribed by doctors and sold by any local pharmacy or hospital today. So I find this difficult to understand. In a country where you can easily be prescribed drugs far more dangerous than cannabis, why is only cannabis banned?
Kang says South Korea's attitudes about marijuana go back to the 1970s, when strongman President Park Chung-hee cracked down on marijuana smokers as a way to constrain singers and artists who spread anti-government messages. The cultural stigma has persisted to this day, especially at the policymaking level. It's still very unclear whether South Korea's tiny move toward allowing cannabis-derived medicine will lead downstream to the kind of broader legalization seen in the United States and elsewhere around the world. Kurt Asian for VOA News, Seoul.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. U.S.-China trade talks reach critical phase. UN investigators says North Korea's human rights record still poor despite diplomacy. United Nations probing North Korea sanctions violations in 20 countries. China tweaks tech supremacy plan. Tokyo Olympics clock hits 500-day mark. You'll find all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and also the voanews.com website. We continue now with VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. A special investigator looking at the human rights situation in Myanmar warns the minority Rohingya Muslims in that country face an uncertain future, as do hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees who fled to Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, due to violence. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, where the investigator's report is under review by the UN Human Rights Council.
Nearly 1 million Rohingya refugees are living in cramped, squalid conditions in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh. Most headed there in August 2017 to escape violence and persecution in Myanmar. Special investigator Yanggi Lee says their welcome is wearing thin, and the situation in Myanmar remains too dangerous for them to return to their homes of origin. Lee says conditions in Myanmar itself have not improved for the Rohingya who remain in Rakhine State. She says she is deeply concerned about their future, as well as for the future of those who fled to Bangladesh and other lands.
I am becoming fearful of an increasingly internationalized situation of the Rohingya, with deportations from India and Saudi Arabia recently, as well as a boat arrival in Malaysia just last week. The boat arrival is particularly worrying. It illustrates the desperate situation of the people who decided to take the perilous journey and harks back to the boat crisis of 2015, which must not be repeated.
That refers to the thousands of Rohingya who set off in fear of their lives from the Bay of Bengal in 2015 in boats that were not seaworthy. Many became stranded at sea and died. Lee says she also is troubled by a proposed plan by Bangladeshi authorities to relocate 23,000 Rohingya refugees from camps in Cox's Bazar to an island in the Bay of Bengal, which she fears may not be truly habitable. The UN investigator also accuses Myanmar's high-ranking military and ex-military officials of making vast profits by plundering the country's natural resources and devastating the state's forests by selling timber on the international market for huge sums.
Revenues from natural resource extraction are needed for vital services and development being diverted to the military and its allies, undermines the civilian government. Democratic reforms, the peace process, sustainable development, and realization of rights.
Myanmar's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Kyo Motun, calls Yanggi Lee's report biased. He accuses her of not complying with the appropriate code of conduct and says that Myanmar will discontinue its cooperation with her. He says his country has embarked on economic and human rights reforms. He says the repatriation of Rohingya refugees should begin expeditiously, noting that all returns would happen in a safe and dignified manner. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, a United Nations investigator finds the easing of tensions on the Korean Peninsula and talks over the country's nuclear program have done nothing to improve human rights in North Korea, saying the situation remains widespread and in violation of international human rights law. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. A new public exhibition has opened in Australia, charting that country's history of espionage and revealing the personal experiences of secret agents. It features the gadgets they used, surveillance images, and case studies. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
This is the first time an Australian intelligence agency has taken part in a public exhibition. Officials hope it will help Australians to consider the nature and purpose of the nation's security organisations at a time when new threats both at home and overseas are emerging. The exhibition explores the age-old challenge of balancing the needs of national security and human rights. The display at Western Sydney University asks whether students who took part in a May Day march in Australia in 1966 or women involved in the anti-conscription Save Our Sons movement were really a threat to the country. Leanne Smith is the director of the Whitlam Institute at Western Sydney University.
Whether it's 1901, 1950, 1970 or now, you can see in each case this tension between national security and individual and community rights and liberties, but also the potential for influence of politics onto national security. It certainly raises a lot of the questions that you could have in a contemporary conversation around national security and human rights today.
Among several case studies on display is one of the most dramatic episodes in Australia's Cold War history. In 1954, Vladimir Petrov, a diplomat at the Soviet embassy in Canberra, defected. He'd passed a file on Soviet activities in Australia in return for cash and political asylum. Petrov and his wife Evdokia had been working as spies, but feared they'd be killed if they went back to the Soviet Union a year after the death of the dictator Joseph Stalin. Also on display at the exhibition in Sydney are gadgets used by Australian spies, including recording equipment hidden in radios, cameras hidden in books, and letters written in invisible ink. Curators say the display gives visitors an opportunity to look at the real stories of espionage behind the gloss of make-believe. Australia has six main intelligence agencies, including the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation. Its work is often compared to the FBI in the United States or Britain's MI5. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, big companies deal with big crises in Asian markets. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news from VOA Asia. Chinese authorities said Tuesday that internment camps in western region of Xinjiang will gradually disappear if a time arises when society does not need them. China is facing a global backlash over the camps where some 1 million Uyghurs and other mostly Muslim Turk minorities are being held. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, Huawei fights back, and Boeing's new 737 MAX 8 plane is grounded in Singapore. These are the topics on today's VOA Asia Business Scene with Skylar Ogden.
Chinese telecoms giant Huawei is mounting a legal and public relations attack to counter the U.S. campaign against the use of its telecommunications equipment. The company has filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government, arguing a law barring its equipment from certain networks is unconstitutional. Huawei's CFO, Meng Wanzhou, is also suing Canadian authorities for wrongful detention after she was arrested for trying to skirt U.S. sanctions on Iran by misleading banks. Wang Yi is the Chinese foreign minister.
It's quite obvious to any fair and unbiased person that the recent action against a particular company, a Chinese individual, is not just a pure judicial case, but deliberate political move to bring them down. We have already and will continue to take all necessary steps and resolutely safeguard the legitimate rights and interests of Chinese companies and citizens.
Over the last several months, a growing number of countries have called for Huawei's technology to be banned because of espionage concerns. The company has been shut out of public contracts in the U.S., and Washington has been pushing for others to follow suit. Australia, New Zealand, and Japan have already banned the company. Huawei continues to deny all allegations and has set up testing centers in Britain, Canada, and continental Europe to allow governments to examine its technology. Foreign Minister Wang Yi says Beijing will take all necessary measures to defend the legitimate rights of the country's companies and individuals. Singapore's aviation regulator has banned the use of Boeing's 737 MAX aircraft in the country's airspace following the deadly plane crash in Ethiopia last weekend. The Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 737 MAX 8 that went down killed all 157 people on board. A Lion Air jet of the same model crashed in Indonesia just months before, killing 189 people. China was the first country to ground the Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes, ordering a dozen carriers to ground the aircraft. Authorities in Ethiopia, Singapore, Indonesia, Morocco, Malaysia, Australia, and Mongolia followed suit, as did carriers in Latin America and South Korea. Boeing's stock has been outperforming the broader market over the last 2 years, but its stock continues to take a hit as air safety regulators and airlines take safety precautions and ground the planes. For VOA's Business Scene, I'm Skylar Ogden.
This news from VOA Asia, the Tokyo Olympic clock has hit 500 days to go. Organizers marked the milestone Tuesday, unveiling the stylized pictogram figures for next year's Tokyo Olympics. The pictogram system was first used extensively in 1964 when the Japanese capital last hosted the Summer Games. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the Seychelles Islands are located in the Indian Ocean, hundreds of miles off the coasts of Somalia and Kenya. It's a great place to do scientific research because the isolated set of islands are relatively pristine. That's why researchers are studying corals in the region, monitoring plastics, and looking for an ancient fish that might live in the deep waters off these islands. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
This is the coelacanth, an enormous bottom-feeding fish. It's still around, even though it should have gone extinct many millions of years ago.
These are two whole coelacanths preserved in alcohol. Before 1938, it wasn't thought this was possible because we only knew them from fossils. Here are two whole examples.
And there are more out there, even though they were once thought to have gone extinct 350 million years ago.
This was the missing link between bony fishes and tetrapods, including human beings. So this was a fantastic expectation. The fact that we hadn't seen them before, except as fossils, meant also that it apparently seemed to have sort of resurrected itself from extinction.
But a science mission about to get underway is going to go looking for more coelacanths in the deep waters off the Indian Ocean islands called the Seychelles. And that's just one of the surprises these researchers are hoping to find when they do their deep water research.
There's been almost no work on the deep waters around the Seychelles. So what's actually living there, we don't know yet. And the intention is to find that out.
There are deep water corals here, and they want to map this undersea world that's mostly blank space.
What we're doing, which is rather unique, is combining the combination of ROVs with submersibles and all these different research tools so we can get a multidisciplinary understanding of how the ocean is changing. We've also developed a whole suite of new technologies as well around the camera systems in particular, and that's going to enable us to gather new 3D maps of the marine ecosystems that we discover.
The researchers say understanding what's happening in the oceans isn't just an academic exercise. It could be a life or death mission.
There's real urgency to what we're doing because the ocean is changing faster than it has done for millions and millions of years. We need to understand how it's changing. We need to understand that now. The ocean is hitting a series of different tipping points, which if that happens, it's going to destroy its resilience to support life as we know on our planet.
The Necton Ocean Research Mission is scheduled to set sail the first week of March. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Pawn shops are popular here in the United States, with 30 million people visiting more than 11,000 stores every year. Most are small independent businesses where customers can buy and sell items or get a quick cash loan. For people without credit or other financial resources, pawn shops can help them get the money they need. The image of pawn shops has improved quite a bit over the past 30 years, as VOA's Deborah Block discovered after she visited a couple of them in the Washington, D.C. area.
You never know what you will find in a pawn shop. Where else can you find a snowblower parked next to a mink jacket? Or a 19th-century French-made clock surrounded by modern-day laptops? Eric Reiser, the owner of several pawn shops in Virginia, would like more people to see what the stores are really like.
You don't see artwork and antiques and rugs. The pawn shops are the new cool place to come into. It's the new chic place.
To also find high-end jewelry, bars made of silver, and collectible sports memorabilia.
We had an original Picasso here, some of the high-end watches, the Rolexes. We actually had a bird head that I had sold to one gentleman that the bird had been extinct for over 100 years.
While sales bring in money, pawn shops make most of their income through cash loans to customers in exchange for an item of value. There is also interest on the loan that is higher than a bank rate. If the money is repaid in 30 days, then the customer gets their item back. Otherwise, the store keeps it for resale. Mike Thoman, manager at Top Dollar Pawn in Waldorf, Maryland, says the average loan is $150.
People don't have any other outlet, to be able to get the money they need to get through the week, say, or put some gas in the tank or pay the electric bill.
Anthony Ruggiero is pawning some items to help pay for his wedding.
I'm getting married in 3 months. I bought a ring here last week. I own a business, so as I checks come in from now, I'll buy my stuff back.
Not all customers are looking for a loan. Some, like Austin Ballard, a music producer in Virginia, come to shop.
It's so much fun to pick up an old instrument that you know is like for instance, an old like 50s or 60s Gibson Les Paul, and just to know that there's probably a lot of history with that. You never know where a guitar's been. It might be on a record. You've heard on the radio.
Like other pawn shops, Top Dollar Pawn has taken a hit from secondhand merchandise being sold on the internet. Although owner Michael Cohen realizes more pawn shops like his may have to start selling items online to survive, he still thinks the brick and mortar stores are here to stay.
There's a lot of people that just pawn shop shop. They just go from pawn shop to pawn shop looking for a good deal. We definitely have our regulars that like to come in here and bargain with us every week.
Because you'll never know what hidden treasures you'll find. Deborah Block, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us on the internet. iTunes and SoundCloud are great places to hear our program, as is VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll also hear us on the radio throughout Asia, like DZUP, 1602 AM radio at the University of the Philippines in Diliman, Quezon City. We thank everyone there who's tuned into our program today. And we send our thanks out to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Cedric Franklin, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.